believe I now have all of the recordings up to the end of last week up. And I was going to, what I was going to do today was to first see if you had any questions on the economic stuff we spent the last three classes on. Then I'm going to do a review of the economic stuff, ending with a chunk that I never got to in the economics, but that really is also relevant to the law and economics and therefore makes a bridge between them. Then take any questions you have on Chapter 7 and then start doing my version, which is not all that close to Chapter 7 because as with the economics, this is sort of my field and I've got my own ideas about how best to present it. But I hope you will, in both cases, read their chapter as well as listening to my version, and then you will have two, not wildly divergent, but somewhat different angles on the same subject. So to begin with, are there any questions on the stuff we did for the last week and a half? No. All right, let me quickly review what we covered. I started out with what economics is, and that is not a definition that all economists would agree with, but I think a noticeable number in, not the same words, but a noticeable number of economists who think of themselves as I do as economic imperialists, meaning that economics ought to reconquer the territory falsely claimed by political science and psychologists and sociology and all sorts of other areas, would agree that the idea that economics is basically an approach to understanding behavior, starting from the assumption of rationality. I sort of implied a couple of times, I'm not sure how explicitly I stated it, in that discussion, that the result you would like to get, in some sense, the coordination problem being solved right, is a result in which everything is produced that is worth producing and only those things worth producing, where what worth producing means is that the value of it to the person who eventually gets it is at least as great as the cost to all of the people whose efforts and other costs have to go into producing it. Sort of a very simple criterion. I'll get into more of that later very shortly. And in addition to producing everything worth producing, something I probably didn't say and should have, is have everything go to whoever values it the most. So that if I value this book more than you do and there's only one copy, it ends up with me. If you value it more, it ends up with you. And then the argument is that a market, at least if you ignore transaction costs and imperfect information and other things, has the second characteristic because whoever is willing to the amount you're willing to offer for something is a measure of how much you value it. From an economist's standpoint, the measure of how much you value it is what you're willing to give up to get it. And then in a market, something is sold at some price. Everybody who values it at or above that price gets it. Everybody who values it less than the price doesn't. That looks like the efficient allocation. And I sketched very briefly what perfect competition looked like, a sort of a simplified picture of the economy. And in that simplified picture, everything is produced at the lowest cost at which it can be produced, if and only if the value to the consumer is at least as great as the cost to the producer producing it. And there are a bunch of reasons why the real world doesn't perfectly conform to that picture, but at least it's sort of a useful first approximation. I ran through briefly the idea of demand curves and supply curves, and then the not obvious, but I would argue very important ideas of consumer surplus and producer surplus. Some way of understanding how much better off you are through the ability to buy some good at some price or through the ability to sell some good or service at some price. From there, I went on to talk about monopoly, which is one of the several reasons why the simplified picture I started with is not a completely accurate picture of the real world, because in the real world, there are occasionally large monopolies and very often small monopolies. That is, every book is a small monopoly, given copyright law, and every specialist seller, if there is one seller of jewelry making supplies in San Jose, which for all I know there is, and if there were no internet or mail order, that seller would be a monopoly, and so forth. Apple has a monopoly of Macintosh computers, although not of computers in general, and since Macintosh computers are not identical to Windows computers or Linux computers, that means that to some degree you can think of it as described by monopoly economics rather than competitive economics. And I discussed why monopoly exists, and one reason is economies of scale. That is, one reason is the situation where a larger firm can produce more cheaply than a smaller firm. And that I argued, is uncommon, though it does exist on the very large-scale style monopolies, but it makes perfectly good sense that if there aren't that many people making jewelry in San Jose, that the cost of making jewelry, making supplies available, would be higher if there were two stores than if there's one store. And in that kind of natural monopoly case, you're likely to end up with only one store. And similarly for a bunch of other things of that sort. The second source of monopoly is government created monopoly, as with copyrights and patents, but also as with any system in which the government restricts the entry to a field. So that if you think about barbers in Chicago, where you have to get licensed, that's really got some of the characteristics of monopoly. There are multiple barbers, but you don't have free entry. Part of the perfect competition is anybody can start a firm who wants to. And I discussed, but on the whole, argued against the idea of artificial monopoly, the idea that a firm with no advantage in cost, just by underselling and driving people out, could establish a monopoly. I think that that is a rare, if it exists at all, situation for reasons I briefly sketched, that basically the large firm, when it's underselling, is losing money much smaller than the small firm is trying to drive out, because it's selling much more at the low cost. And there doesn't seem to be evidence that Standard Oil, which is the standard example, actually engaged in such an activity. What's wrong with monopoly? And the standard traditional economist's answer is that the price at which a monopoly maximizes its profit is above the marginal cost. Marginal cost being what it would cost to produce, to increase output by one unit. That means that there are people who value the good at more than producing one more unit of the good would cost who don't get it. And that is a wasteful arrangement, as it were, is a failure to maximize the total benefit to everybody, so to speak. Again, I'll get back to what that means in a minute or two. And second thing wrong with it, which is really not in the traditional literature, which is really due to Gordon Tullock, but which I think is a legitimate point, is that the potential for monopoly profits leads to rent-seeking, meaning that firms are willing to lose money for a while in order to establish themselves as the one firm which is the first one in that niche. And if you're a natural monopoly, it's never going to pay anybody else to enter that niche. I mean, then you have monopoly profits. And I ran through the analogous case, I think, of the railroad in the, I don't know, it's a case of that, my railroad going into a valley somewhere. Famous case, not from Tullock, written later, is the Homesteading Act, where the argument is that you got possession of an area of land by settling it and doing certain things and farming it and, I think, growing a fruit tree. I don't remember what the list of requirements were. And what you would like people to do is to go out and settle land at the point when farming that land produced at least as much as it cost them to do. But if they did that, someone else would be there first, because by farming the land, you get this very valuable property right over the land, which in the future will be worth a lot as the settlement moves west, and therefore there's an incentive to premature settlement. That's an interesting argument. If I had more time, I could discuss that in greater depth. In particular, the obvious alternative would be to auction off the land, but if you really look at the early U.S. history, what you see is that there were attempts to do that earlier than homesteading, and for various reasons they didn't work very well. I'm not going to go into that now. All right, what are the solutions to monopoly? And I ran through this, what I think of as sort of the three standard solutions, isn't really the right term, the three standard institutional frameworks. One of them is the unregulated private monopoly, and just put up with the fact that it's going to sell at a price above marginal cost. One is the regulated private monopoly, and that's the way utilities are very often handled in the U.S. with an electric company or a water company or whatever. Sometimes they're government-owned, but often they're a private firm with what's called rate of return regulation. Rate of return regulation really amounts to trying to force the firm to sell at about average cost. You can't sell at marginal cost because economies of scale are occurring where marginal cost, where it costs less to produce the 1,000th unit than the 100th unit, and therefore your average is higher than your margin, and therefore if you sell at marginal cost, you'll go bankrupt. You could make them sell at marginal cost if you're willing to subsidize them. Without that, the regulator simply tries to set it so that on average, the investors are getting a market rate of return, which means that the firm is paying all its other costs plus paying the cost of its capital, which means you're really setting price equal to average cost. And that has a variety of problems, which I'm not going to go into at this point. And then the third alternative is government-run monopoly, which is what the post office used to be explicitly. It's nominally at least private at this point, and what the public school system pretty much is, given that it's got a subsidy so large that only a small part of the market is willing to pay the cost of something the government's giving away for free, and so forth. So, and government-run monopoly has a variety of problems as well, and again, I sketched those very briefly last time, and you know, if people want at some point we can discuss them more, but I'm not sure it's that urgent. Let me go on to something which I think I touched on, but I probably want to say a little bit more about, and that's the idea of what economists refer to as market failure. And market failure is one of these terms that sounds self-explanatory, like the theory of relativity, which sounds though means that everything is relative, which isn't what it means. And similar, yeah.
Going back to the solutions for monopoly you just discussed.
Yep.
Why don't those include like government breakups of monopoly, where the government
You're right. I was considering actual monopoly, and the problem is you could try to break up the monopoly. But since once you've broken it up, the largest firm can make money selling at a price which everybody else loses money, because natural monopoly costs go down with the size of the firm goes up. Unless you keep breaking it up, you know, every 5 years or something, you're going to be back there. And if you did keep breaking it up, you would be getting rid of the monopoly only at the cost of having higher production costs than you otherwise would. I mean, I would have said that the problem in that context isn't that you have a monopoly. The problem is that the cost structure of the firms is such that you can't have a competitive market. Because in a competitive market, what's basically happening is that the firm at the optimal size is small compared to the market size. Therefore, you end up with an equilibrium with many firms. So you're right. I could have included that, and that is legitimate if the monopoly is coming from something other than a natural monopoly. So that if you believe in the artificial monopoly, if you believe in the sort of I would say urban legend about Standard Oil, then you would say fine, breaking it up solves the problem. The clearest case, I would argue, is a government-created monopoly, where the only reason that there is only one firm. If you go back to what monopoly originally meant, you know, 400 years ago, 500 years ago, it's that the government says we will auction off to the highest bidder the right to be the only seller of salt in England, and that's a way of getting revenue. Now, it might be better or worse than other ways of getting revenue, but insofar as the problem is monopoly, you say, well, don't do that. Let anybody sell salt who wants to, and you end up with a competitive market. And in the U.S. case, for example, it is illegal to compete with the post office in first-class mail due to the private express statutes. There was, in fact, a 19th century entrepreneur by the name of Lysander Spooner who started the American Letter Mail Company, seriously undercut the post office, I think partly because he had this brilliant idea of using railroads to carry the mail. And the story, at least as I heard it, and I don't know if it's really true or if it only ought to be true, is that he made the mistake of making a bid to carry the U.S. government's mail at half the post office's price. And at that point, they got annoyed at him and shut him down and for violating the private express statutes. But that's a case where you have a monopoly enforced by the government. It might turn out to be a natural monopoly, but if we look at package delivery, it looks as though the equilibrium in that is to have not a huge number of firms, but several firms. UPS and FedEx seem to compete with each other just fine, and with the post office, of course, but not in first-class mail because they're not allowed to. So other questions? Please do feel free to stop me at any point, because otherwise I tend to just keep going. And so market failure sounds as though it means markets not doing good things. But unless you define markets very, very broadly, that isn't really what it means. What market failure really means, I think, is a situation where individual rationality doesn't lead to group rationality. And I think I may have described to you my standard scenario of a line of spearmen facing a line of charging horsemen with spears, and why it's in the rational interest of each guy to run away, even though they're all better off if they all stand. And that would be an example of market failure in that sense. And you could think of quite a lot of other examples. So if you think about it, sort of part of the simple-minded argument in favor of free market laissez-faire arrangements is people are rational, everybody does the right thing, so we get the right result. And market failure correctly points out that there are certain circumstances in which that implication doesn't hold, because I'm rational and you're rational, but we aren't rational. I guess for those who are familiar, I guess we discussed under game theory the case of prisoner's dilemma. Prisoner's dilemma is the two-person version of market failure, basically, each person. Which is part of why it's interesting. Each person is making the right decision, and they're both worse off as a result. And the reason Well, one form of market failure, one very common form, is externalities, where my action is imposing either costs or benefits on other people whose consent I don't need or who I can't charge for the benefits. I therefore ignore those costs or benefits. I therefore take the action which maximizes my net benefit, but not our net benefit. All right, and air pollution is sort of a standard example of that, where my factory produces sulfur dioxide. In a legal regime where I'm free to do that, I take account of all the other costs of producing steel or whatever I'm producing, but I don't take account of the cost of the people downwind of having the air they breathe smell bad or whatever other negative consequences are from sulfur dioxide, and the result is that I'm willing to sell steel below its real cost of production because I'm not paying that real cost, and I have no incentive to reduce my pollution even if there are relatively inexpensive ways of doing so. That's the externality problem. And there are then, I think, three interesting categories of ways one can try to deal with that problem. And the first is direct regulation. The EPA says if you're a power station, you must take out 80% of the sulfur in your coal before it gets out of the smokestack, or you must have high smokestacks, if I gather, for some kinds of air pollution that reduces it, or you are not allowed to use product X, to use X as an ingredient because it has some bad consequence, things of that sort. And that has some fairly serious problems, if you think about it, of two sorts, and there are two sorts which are going to keep recurring in a lot of our discussion. One of them is that with the best will in the world, the regulators don't really have the information they need to make all of these decisions. They don't know what the cost is of controlling pollution in various ways, which is probably going to be different for each power station, each firm, and so forth. And the second is there's no reason why the regulator should have the best will in the world, that the regulator, just like the monopolist and just like the polluting steel industry, the regulator is also a person with his own objectives, and there's no reason to expect him to replace his own objectives with the welfare of the society. And then you can think of lots of ways in which regulators might find it either personally or politically profitable to do other things. So one of the standard stories in regulation, due really to George Stigler quite a long time ago, is what's referred to as capture theory, which is that what typically happens with regulatory agencies is that the political interest group most interested in what they're doing is the industry they're regulating, and therefore it usually can outbid everybody else for getting control of the regulatory agency and then use the agency for things like keeping down competition and keeping up prices. And that's arguably the story of both the Interstate Commerce Commission and the Civil Aeronautics Board. Those are two famous examples. The second alternative, and the one which for a long time was the one the economists liked, is what we refer to as Pigouvian taxes, or sometimes effluent fees, and the basic idea is charging people for their externalities. So if I'm putting out the sulfur dioxide, instead of the EPA telling me what I have to do, they just do their best to estimate how much damage each ton of sulfur dioxide does, and then send me a bill. And it's then up to me to figure out whether I can reduce that at a cost less than the damage done, in which case it's right for me to do so. And it's also up to me to then include that bill in the cost of producing steel, which means that steel becomes more expensive, and one way of polluting less is to produce less steel, which is going to happen when the price of steel includes the price of the pollution. That's the Pigouvian solution, effluent fee approach. And the third possibility is COSE's approach to it. COSE really, in a certain sense, revolutionized the field in the 1960s when he pointed out what was wrong, several things wrong with COSE's argument. With Pigou's argument. The first thing was that Pigou was thinking of externalities as we always had thought of them, as I impose a cost on you. But that's really wrong. My pollution would do no harm if nobody chose to live downwind from me. It's really we are creating a cost. And in the pollution case, we are creating a cost that you are bearing. But if the rule were a Pigouvian tax, then we are creating a cost that I'm bearing. Both of us are bearing if it's tax rather than if it's a tort damages, then we're creating a cost that I'm bearing because I'm compensating you. If it's a standard Pigouvian tax, we are creating a cost. Both of us are bearing it, and the government's, that means we're paying twice, but the extra one is going to the government. It's fine. All right, makes sense? So Co says, well, if it's jointly caused, you don't know a priori which of the two of us ought to change his behavior in order to solve the problem. There will be some externality cases where the person you are thinking of as the creator of the externality should stop creating it, but there will be other circumstances where the person you are thinking of, you, Pigou, thinks is the victim, should change what he's doing in order to eliminate the problem. And there might be ones where both of them should adapt in varying ways. And then Coase has the example of this real English case with a doctor who builds his consulting room right next to the factory making candy, which has got a machine that vibrates the wall, and he can't use his stethoscope to listen to people. And in that case, it certainly looks as though the sensible solution would be for the doctor who started out building his consulting room on the underside of his house. And lots and lots of other examples of different sorts. Yeah.
What would Coase say about a creator of an externality that wouldn't be realized until long after the creator has left the game? So,
by realized, you mean it wouldn't happen or people wouldn't know about it?
I probably mean that it wouldn't happen, but I suppose also...
But there are different cases. If people literally won't know about it, then nothing at all is going to be done under any institutions, right? You can't solve problems that nobody knows are there. But in the case, if you imagine that I do something which 20 years later is going to create a problem. And then Pigou would say, if we know about it now, we can charge me now with appropriate discounting for the costs I'm going to impose in 20 years. Coase would say, I haven't gotten to the second step of Coase's argument, but the second step of Coase's argument is to say, as long as we've defined who has what rights, we can just let the parties bargain. So if imagine that I am doing something which is, quote, polluting, unquote, your land, but that pollution will have no effect for a long time for some reason. And maybe it's a cumulative poison, like mercury or something, and the effect of the next few years isn't going to be loud enough for anybody to notice, but over 20 years it'll have a serious effect. In that case, if we know about it, Coase would say, if I have the right to do that legally, if that's the way the legal system is set up, you have an incentive to go to me and buy that right. You have an incentive to go to me and say, all right, let's bargain. I'm willing to pay you not to emit mercury that's going onto my land or my water or whatever it is. Reverse it. If you've got the right, if the legal rule is I'm not allowed to emit mercury that ends up on your land without your permission, which would be an alternative extreme system, then if it's really true that the amount of money I save by being able to do that is much larger than the damage to you, I've got an incentive to buy the land from you or to buy permission from you to damage it in that way. So the second step, the first step of Coase's argument I like to describe as nothing works, because the Pigouvian tax, if it's put on the wrong person, may move you away from the efficient solution instead of toward the efficient solution. If you imagine the case where the initial property rule is I am allowed to emit sulfur dioxide, and where it would do no harm unless people decided to live downwind, and there are lots of places that people live, so I'm going to assume the right efficient solution is just not to have housing downwind from my factory, then a rule which says that if you build downwind, I have to pay a fine, and the fine is large enough so I'll stop emitting. The fine doesn't stop me emitting, then you aren't going to build downwind anyway because you don't want sulfur dioxide. But imagine the fine is large enough to stop me emitting. Then you say, well, here's some nice land. It's cheap because that all that sulfur dioxide blowing over it. I'm going to buy some of it and build myself a house. I will then complain to the government. The government will fine him. He'll stop polluting, and I'm fine. That's giving the inefficient solution to the problem because, by assumption, it's costly for me to stop polluting, and would be easier for you just not to build a house there. So Coase says, under some circumstances, Pigou's rule will change us from the right answer to the wrong answer, under others from the wrong answer to the right answer. So the second step of Coase's argument, as long as we know who's got the rights, the parties can bargain between themselves for the efficient outcome. And the third step is, that would happen in a world without transaction costs, but in a world with transaction costs, sometimes that bargaining will be blocked by the fact that it requires a unanimous decision by 1,000 people living downwind to pay me to stop polluting, or it requires a unanimous decision by 1,000 people downwind to give me permission to pollute if we imagine a legal regime where each of them has an absolute right not to be polluted, and so forth. So the third step of Coase's argument is that it isn't really that the existence of externalities caused the problem, it's that the existence of transaction costs that block the things that would solve the the externality problem is blocking. I was looking at the Wikipedia piece on Coase, and it just gets it wrong, because it acts as if it was that middle step that was his, that was what he got the Nobel Prize for, the so-called Coase theorem, which is that in a world without transaction costs, any initial definition of rights will give you an efficient outcome. But in fact, that's just one bit in the middle of a much longer and more sophisticated argument. Anyway, I really ought to edit that, but I remember that in the editing of Wikipedia. So in any case, those are sort of three different ways. Looking at an externality, I should say, are also central to the whole law and econ project, because a lot of the law and econ project, think about tort law, for example, it's dealing with the fact that when I drive carelessly and damage your car, I'm imposing an externality on you, and when I choose to rob you, I'm imposing an externality on you, and lots of other things of that sort. So it's a fairly central idea. These ideas are central, and in fact, Coase's article was published in the Journal of Law and Economics originally. Yeah, one of the things that irritated me a little bit reading this book is that they write as if the Journal of Legal Studies was the first journal in law and economics, whereas in fact it was the second journal in law and economics. JLE was the first, yeah.
Well, last thoughts, you said that when one person steals, say, $100 from another, that's, we should punish that because there's the cost of the transaction.
I wouldn't call it exactly the transaction. I don't think of it as a transaction cost, that's what you call it. I'm saying because the ability, I would have called it rent-seeking, as what I was saying before. The ability to steal from you means I have an incentive spending resources on being able to steal from you, on, you know, watching your house to see when you're out, training myself in picking locks or picking pockets or whatever. And that if you think about it, in a world where there are lots of people who could be thieves, they're going to keep increasing their expenditure on being thieves, as it were, until the next person who's thinking becoming a thief finds that he does just about as well doing that or working at McDonald's, whatever his alternative is. So I was actually going to get back to that later in this class, but I think it's useful to think of that as a rent-seeking argument. Just the same way I was saying last time that the railroad would end up being built early enough to wipe out the monopoly profit. It's the same argument. Depends on there being other people who know about the situation and have the same costs and so forth. If one person happens to be better at building railroads, then he's going to still get some benefit from it. All right. One of the points worth making about why market failure isn't really about markets in the normal sense is that market failure is a problem not only with competitive private markets, but also with the political alternatives to those markets, because we again have individuals acting in their own interests, rationally acting in their own interests, economists would like to believe, but again, we don't have a mechanism where the sum total of individual rationality ends up as group rationality. We don't have a mechanism, as far as I know, a political mechanism for making it in the interest of the legislature to pass bad, to pass good laws, or making it in the interest of the regulators to regulate in the general interest or things of that sort. And as I think I may have pointed out last time, one example, I should say, I put this in terms of externalities, but public goods are really the same issue in slightly different language. Public good, you can think of as a positive externality. It's a case where I produce something, all of you can get it if I produce it, therefore I can't go to each of you and say I'll only produce it if you pay me for it, and then you have the problem of underproduction. I won't produce it even though it's worth producing. And if you think about it, an informed electorate is a public good, that if I spend time and effort figuring out whether Obama or McCain or whoever the next candidate will make a better president, if I do a good job of that, everybody in the country benefits by it. I only get $1/300,000,000 for the benefit. I have little incentive to do it. And that explains why most people are politically ignorant. That unless you like politics or unless you're a professional and you can actually make a living out of selling your expertise, there's no good reason to pay much attention to who's the best president. Or unless you're a very generous, altruistic person who really wants to benefit everybody else in the world. Which you could be. That's possible. Anyway, so that's market failure. Let me go on to something which I think they discussed in the previous chapter, but I didn't get to, and so I will think of as discussing in this chapter, and that's what I refer to as economic efficiency, what Posner in his work refers to, I think, even more confusingly, as wealth maximization, and that this gets back to what I referred to before as maximizing the size of the pie, that I sort of went over that fairly quickly, because otherwise you have to spend some time on it, which I'm about to do. But the real question is, do we have a reasonable criterion for whether the system is working right? For designing economies or designing legal systems, if we think of it in terms of something like, how do we maximize the total benefit to everybody, what does that mean? And a philosopher will tell you, well, that's an old unsolved problem. For utilitarians, who people say we want to maximize the total of human happiness, how do we trade off happiness between two different people? How do we decide whether something makes you happier than it makes him unhappy? Decide whether you're for or against it. And I think of this from the standpoint of an economist as people keep coming to us with questions, and they say, should we have tariffs? And I look at them with sort of a puzzled expression, say, what does this word should mean? You want to know about tariffs? I'll be glad to say what the consequences of tariffs are. Tariffs will do X, Y, and Z. But and they say, no, are they a good thing? And I say, well, you know, the moral philosophy department is down the hall. That's not my department. But they are very insistent, and they want us to answer questions of the form should. And so finally, we bend to their pressure, and we say, look, here's what we'll offer you. I have a criterion of shouldness. It's not a very good criterion of shouldness. I admit that coming in. It has only two useful characteristics. One of them is it has enough correlation with what a good criterion would be like if only we had one, so that the fact that something meets this condition is at least a pretty good reason to suspect that it's a good thing, though it might not be. And the second is that unlike fancier versions, I can tell you how to figure out what achieves it. And this criterion of shouldness, which I owe to Alfred Marshall, who was the man who put modern economics together a little over 100 years ago, and I like to refer to as Marshall efficiency, consists of saying for any change, for each person affected, what's the largest sum he would pay to get it, to get the effect, or pay to prevent it. Take the amount people would pay to get it as positive, to prevent it as negative, and add the number up. If the number is positive, we will call the change an economic improvement. If the number is negative, we will call the change an economic worsening. So if any of you are philosophers, this is what utilitarianism would be if we believed that everybody had the same marginal utility of income. If for everybody a dollar represented the same amount of happiness. And of course, the fact that it doesn't is one of the reasons why it's an imperfect criterion. But at least it's a fairly clearly stated criterion. We're going to sum, not value in terms of how many dollars we get. This is not a statement of how much does your income go up or down. As we've just discussed in the context of consumer and producer surplus, you can talk about the dollar value of the opportunity to buy apples at a dollar. Now, the opportunity to buy apples at a dollar instead of not buying apples means you have fewer dollars because you spend some of the one apples, but you have more apples, and the apples are worth more to you than the dollars, which is why you bought them. So we can therefore talk about the net value to you of that opportunity. And then the Marshall criterion says we're maximizing the sum of that, essentially, and that's one reason why producer and consumer surplus, which I think Marshall invented, are useful tools, because they give us the analytic tools to say, does this change increase total value to humans or decrease it? All right? Is it clear to people, not whether it's good or bad, but what my criterion is, what Marshall efficiency is? Yes? No? I'm not suggesting that you would use it by actually asking people things. You use it by things more like offering them apples and seeing if they buy them. So that the argument is, for example, going back to what I said earlier, the mere fact that apples are sold to everybody at the same price means they will be distributed among people in the way that maximizes Marshall efficiency. Because it means that apples go to everybody who values them at above that price, to nobody who values them at below price. In order to change it, you would have to take an apple from somebody who values it at more than the price, give it to somebody who values it at less. That's going to impose a cost on the loser larger than the benefit on the winner. Make sense? So that's a very, very simple example. Without asking anybody any questions at all about how they value things, you can say this particular set of institutions in this respect will maximize marginal efficiency. And similarly, I mentioned briefly the idea of price discrimination by monopolies, and one argument against price discrimination is that it fails to allocate goods in that way, because if you're in the country where they charge the high price, you don't buy the good even though it's worth to you a little bit less than that high price, but it's worth more to you than it is to the guy who buys it in the low price. Yeah.
Does an economist make any claim at all about how humans go about populating their utility functions?
That's a good question. I think the answer is we don't have a good theoretical basis for such a claim. we have sort of casual knowledge that we know human beings, you know, don't like being hungry, they don't like being sick. If we're going a little fancier, we say we also don't like those near and dear to them being hungry and sick. But there isn't really a coherent underlying theory of what utility functions are. And I think that I would argue, is one of the big advantages that evolutionary biology has over economics. Because evolutionary biology has an absolutely clean answer to that question, which we owe to Darwin. It's a little more complicated than people think, because I can be reproductively successful not only by reproducing, but by keeping my nephews alive, say, for them to reproduce with some of my genes. Economics really doesn't. There is one very interesting essay by Becker and Stigler, whose title is De Gustibus Non Disputans Dum Est, which, as you may know, is the Latin phrase for there's no arguing about tastes. And they are reversing the usual meaning, because what their essay is arguing is that instead of attributing people's differing behavior to different tastes, it would make more sense to assume everybody has exactly the same tastes, but the tastes are for some sort of ultimate goods, like pleasure, for example, life. And that how we differ is the technologies by which we convert real goods into ultimate goods. Because Becker and Stigler argue we know much more about dealing with technologies than dealing with tastes, and therefore would like to push as much of the question into that area as possible. So they did not succeed in convincing the rest of the profession, but it's a neat article. I sort of like the fact that they're exactly reversing the phrase. What they're saying is not tastes are beyond knowledge, but we don't argue about tastes, we all have the same tastes. Or I'm proposing a methodology in which we assume that. Anyway, but the answer is we really don't have a very good theory. What we really have is we're human beings, we have a rough idea of what human beings want, and what we can really talk about is under what situations people get what they want, not what they want. But of course you can imagine utility functions which would make it very hard for markets or maybe even political institutions to give people what they want, because if my utility function, take the simple case which really underlies, I think, Bork's reason for not being a libertarian. Suppose I have a taste for other people not reading pornography. All right? Bork says, you libertarians say I'm not allowed to indulge that taste through the law. But he says, if I do have that taste, why is it you're reading pornography just like you're polluting my ear? You're taking an action that imposes a cost on me, and we have no theory about what utility function you're supposed to be. It's quite a sophisticated argument, though I think there are possible rebuttals to it. So what are the obvious arguments against this criterion, assuming people are happy they understand what Marshall's criterion is? The first obvious argument from any utilitarian, and Marshall was in fact a utilitarian, is, but a dollar is worth much less to Bill Gates than it is to a starving beggar. And consequently, this criterion says if there is some change that makes Gates $10 better off and the starving beggar $9 worse off, it's a good thing. We've had a net increase of value by a dollar. That surely is wrong. And Marshall was concerned with that answer because, as I say, he was in fact a utilitarian. And he, I think, was really thinking of efficiency as sort of the best proxy for total utility that he had available. And his main answer, as I remember, is that most issues we're considering do not affect one beggar and one rich person. That most of the issues economists are considering affect all of the inhabitants of Manchester and all the inhabitants of London. Well, Manchester has rich people and poor people. London has rich people and poor people. So most of the time, the same change that will maximize dollar value would also maximize utility if you could measure it, because the differences are going to average out across that population. And that's... it's a little better than hand-waving, but not as good as you'd like. But it would certainly apply to many things. A second answer one could make, and I think some people in law and econ are inclined to make, is legal rules are not a very good way of redistributing income. In particular, if a court decides that it will always favor poor tenants over rich landlords, the result of that is to make it more expensive to rent apartments to poor tenants. The result of that is that the rents for poor tenants get higher because landlords don't want to rent to them for fear that they'll be unable to evict them, for example, when they don't pay their rent. And ultimately, therefore, the person that the court is trying to favor ends up being injured, not helped. And that could be a long argument, but at least for some categories of legal rules, it's probably right. But there's another argument, and it's an argument which one of the authors of this, in fact, two of the authors of this book, Chevelle and Kaplow, think they invented. But as I pointed out to them, I don't know if they were listening at the time, I saw it made by an economist they had probably never heard of, a Vietnamese Australian by the name of Quang Ung, about 20 years before they published their article. And I thought it was a neat argument. Ung is the only utilitarian I personally know. He's a very bright and interesting guy. And his argument essentially is, imagine a society where you could try to transfer money from rich people. This is going back a step. The argument that money is worth more to poor people than rich people is sort of an underlying argument for why you should redistribute. The people say, look, if we tax Bill Gates $1,000 and distribute that $1 each to 1,000 poor people, isn't the world a better place? It's hardly for Gates doesn't really mind losing the $1,000. He might even agree. He has, after all, given away a lot of his money, and the poor people really like getting the $1,000. And that's an argument for redistribution in any form. And Ung accepts the argument. He says, look, we've got two different ways we could do it. One of them is a straightforward tax and transfer, you know, welfare system or something similar. The other is in constructing our laws by weighting the welfare of poor people more than the welfare of rich people in judging whether a legal rule is good. Well, Ung says, what's the limit to tax and transfer redistribution? And he says, the limit to it is that transferring that dollar costs something. And why does it cost something? Because the fact that the rich person knows that the more money he makes, the more taxes he'll pay, means that rich people sometimes won't do productive things worth doing because they're only getting $8 from every $10 worth of value they produce. That's a net deadweight cost. The deadweight cost is not the money they pay, but the stuff they don't do that's worth doing because they'll be taxed if they do it. Meanwhile, the recipient has less of an incentive to do things that raise his income, because the higher his income is, the less money he'll get under a tax and transfer scheme. So Kung says, when you're doing your tax and transfer, you're really, if you allow for all those cases, what you're really doing is not taking $1,000 from Gates and distributing $1,000 among the poor. You're taking $1,100 from Gates and distributing $900 among the poor, with a $100 deadweight loss from Gates' disincentives and a $100 deadweight loss from the recipients. Say, making up numbers, but that's the idea. Now he says that may still be worth doing, because $900 to a poor person may still have more utility than $1,100 to a rich person. But you keep doing it, and those numbers slide, and when do you stop? You stop when the cost of your redistribution in inefficient incentives just balances the gain from a little more redistribution in shifting to higher marginal utility recipients. Does the argument make sense so far? Soong says, now let's suppose you could do it instead via the legal mechanism. So what we're going to do is to pass some legal rule, which measured by Marshall's criteria is a bad thing, because the legal rule hurts Gates by $1,000 and helps the poorest by only $900. Well, Ung says, in addition to that, the legal rule is going to have exactly the same bad effect as the direct transfer, because since on average we've now got a legal system which on average penalizes rich people and rewards poor people, that gives you an incentive not to be rich less of an incentive not to be poor. Therefore, the redistribution via the legal system is going to have the same costs as redistribution via the tax and transfer, plus the cost of the fact that you're choosing an inefficient legal rule. Soong says, if you believe in equality, it's always better to do your redistribution directly via tax and transfer rather than indirectly versus via legal rules. And that's an interesting and ingenious argument, a way of making the utilitarian approach in some sense consistent with the Marshallian approach. And if Marshall had known that argument, I'm sure he would have liked it, because it lets him both take the criterion he wants to use and be a good utilitarian while he's doing it. I'm not sure the argument is right. You might be able to make arguments about why the tax and transfer has some additional cost, the other one doesn't. But at least it's a plausible and interesting argument. In any case, so that's a possible way of answering it. Second objection to the criterion is that it's taking as the right measure of the value of something to you how much you would give for it. Well, what's the obvious objection to that? Can you think of examples where you are suspicious of that definition of value? Anybody? Nobody. Is heroin valuable to heroin addicts? Certainly by that criterion it is, right? They're willing to give lots of money. But a lot of people would say yes, but they'd be better off without it. Maybe they're wrong. But it's certainly a not absurd claim to say people don't always know their own interests or don't always act in their interests. The way I like to put it is that I observe that there is a bowl of potato chips next to me. It will mysteriously empty itself, despite the fact that I'm overweight. I try to deal with that by not having bowls of potato chips next to me. But the fact that that happens suggests that my own behavior is imperfectly rational, that to some extent I yield to temptation. Whose line is that I can resist anything but temptation, and therefore that my behavior does not fully meet the requirement. And the way I like to put it is it implies that the value of heroin to the addict is just like the value of insulin to the diabetic. And a lot of people would reject that. So that's the second reason one might object to this criterion. A third reason is that you might believe that values to humans aren't all that matter. You might say that there are principles coming from God. You might say that even if by cheating and lying you could increase the total of human happiness, that would be a bad thing to do because it's wicked to cheat and lie. A lot of people feel that way, whether or not they'd say it explicitly. You might say, well, somewhere out in the forest there is a redwood tree, which is the oldest tree in the world. It would be a bad thing for that tree to be destroyed, even if no human knew it. So you could imagine at least things that it seems intuitive to people matter other than whether they make people happy or unhappy, other than whether people care about them, as it were. So I think all of those are legitimate critiques of the Marshallian approach, that A, it treats a dollar as a dollar, B, it assumes people know their own welfare, and a lot of us suspect that at least other people don't, some of us even aren't sure if we do, and C, it assumes that things humans desire are all that matter in the world. And those are, I think, all possible. I guess to put it differently, imagine a world where nobody appreciates Shakespeare due to bad education. We still have some kind of a feeling that if all of the copies of Shakespeare's work were wiped out, that would be a bad thing. Even if no, it's sort of odd, because if nobody's ever going to read it, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's a bad thing because it's the future. But there's some feeling that the Mona Lisa or the Venus de Milo or Hamlet somehow have an intrinsic value and in addition to their value to people. And I don't know if it's right or not, but I think there's a gut-level feeling of that. Anyway, so what are the answers to this criteria? I've already given the answer to the first one. Two answers, Marshall's answer and Ung's answer. I think the answer to the second one about who do you know your value is only that while my judgment of my value may not be correct, it's not clear there's any better alternative, because the alternative to deciding what the outcomes are by people's, by what economists call revealed preference, by what you're willing to give up to get something, is someone else deciding what my values are. That someone else, while he may not have the biases of liking potato chips, is going to have much less information about me than I have. And why should I trust him? Won't he then make the decision in his interest rather than mine? So the argument is that the best you can reasonably hope to achieve is maximizing Marshall efficiency, even if it's not the best one can imagine. And then, again, for the non-human values, if nobody values it, it's hard to imagine any human institutions that lack to preserve it. And so, again, it may be the best you can do. Anyway, that sort of is my brief summary on economic efficiency. The reason it's relevant to law and econ is that Richard Posner, who was probably the most influential single figure in the field, maybe exception of Coase, long ago offered a conjecture. And his conjecture was that you could best understand common law as a set of legal rules as if designed to maximize economic efficiency. And it's not clear if that conjecture is right. If sufficiently curious, my book Law's Order is available for free online. And that question sort of runs through the book, and I've got a summary in the final chapter of what I think is evidence both for and against the Posner conjecture. But it's been a very productive conjecture, intellectually speaking, because having made that conjecture, he now sets the rest of us to the task of, for any particular legal issue, for strict liability versus negligence, for coming to the nuisance defense, for all sorts of things, is this rule economically efficient? Or putting it differently, what legal rule would be economically efficient? And then you say, well, does that correspond to what the legal rules really are? And even if they weren't, you learn a good deal. I think that one of the things that helps unify different fields of the law is that you can ask for each of them the question, what rules in this field would be economically efficient, and you use roughly the same tools to answer that question. Now, Posner's conjecture is a positive, not a normative one. Posner's conjecture is that that's what the common law is like. It's easily confused with the related normative claim, that's what it ought to be like. Posner probably believes both. And following Marshall, I would say that on the whole, making legal rules more efficient is probably a good thing, but not necessarily or rigorously a priori a good thing, since it's only an imperfect criterion of goodness in various ways. But in any case, efficiency gets into law and econ in those two different ways, in the attempt to test Posner's conjecture, and in the attempt to figure out what economically efficient legal rules would be, because people think that's a good thing. It is not, I would say, a defining feature of law and econ that you could imagine the economic approach, which I'll be discussing more of in a minute, being applied to other questions. So you might say, somebody could have a different conjecture. Somebody could say the legal system is designed to maximize the income of judges. And then you could try to use economic methods to figure out if that's true or not. Somebody could say it's designed to maximize the economic welfare of lawyers, which is maybe a defensible theory. I've at least seen an interesting piece where somebody argued that the decisions of judges are consistently biased in favor of the professional interests of lawyers, that judges allow the legal profession to do things they wouldn't allow other professions to do, and that the reason is that all judges have been lawyers, judges largely associate with lawyers, and therefore their attitudes are biased in favor of lawyers. So that could still be within an economic approach. It would just be one looking at a different conjecture. Similarly, you might say, my objective is not to maximize the happiness of mankind. My objective is to maximize the economic wealth of the United States. And an economist would be suspicious of that objective because it's hard to know how you define economic wealth. Does leisure count as a benefit, for example? But you can imagine some definition of that and then using the same tools to figure out how to do that. Or equality. You could have an egalitarian who says, my objective is a legal system that will make people's income as nearly as possible equal. Let's use these tools to figure out how we do that. And that would be a perfectly legitimate use of the same tools. Anyway. All right, so now let me stop for a moment. I'm now at the point when I want to know if you have questions about Chapter 7 before I launch out into my own exposition of what economic analysis was. And if people want the long version, you have to wait 2 years and take my law and econ course, which I don't expect to give next year. All right, no questions on Chapter 7. So let me start with my standard explanation of what economic analysis of law is, which is to imagine that you... Have I gone through the question of death penalty for life... death penalty for armed robbery? No, life imprisonment for armed robbery in this class? I have, all right. As I mentioned, I keep getting confused because I'm teaching two different classes that cover some of the same stuff. So that would be an example where you're saying, how would the rational armed robber react to knowing that the punishment for armed robbery and for armed robbery plus murder is the same? And the simple answer is, he would then say, I should kill the victim any time doing so produces me a benefit. And since if I kill the victim can't identify me, it's quite likely it will produce a benefit. And then an economist might well say, whether you think this law is fair or unfair, just or unjust, don't do it, because it has an undesirable consequence. Frankly, the only undesirable consequences. Take a different example, which I also sort of like, and that's that you go mountain climbing with your rich uncle, and you take a convenient opportunity in an isolated position to push him off a cliff, since you happen to be his heir. And by great bad fortune, the next mountain over, or the next peak over, has a bird watcher on it, who happened to have his camera with its telescopic lens pointed in exactly the wrong direction when you pushed your uncle off the cliff. And the result is that you find yourself in court accused of murder. And after the court concludes that you are guilty, your lawyer says to the judge, Your Honor, I have to admit that this regrettable incident did indeed happen, as Your Honor believes, but I must point out to you that there is really nothing to be achieved by punishing my client, because after all, he has no more rich uncles. And if he did have another rich uncle, I can assure you he would not go mountain climbing with him. So therefore, there is nothing to be done by jailing or executing my client, so I would appreciate it if now that you've convicted him, you would let him go. And the question is, why is that argument wrong? And one tempting answer gets to the idea of justice, which is not an idea that I think really fits very well into the law and economic approach, although one interesting question one might eventually get to is to what extent does intuitions of justice fit the conclusions of law and econ, but if so, it's coming out at the end, not going in at the beginning. So, but a different answer, and the economist's answer, and the answer of some judges in the past, long before law and econ existed as a field, is the reason we want to punish you is not to prevent you from pushing a rich uncle off a cliff, but prevent the next nephew in that situation from pushing a rich uncle off a cliff. That what we're doing is establishing rules which give people incentives to behave in the way we want them to behave. So that in that sense, the law and econ approach is a forward-looking, not a backward-looking approach. That rather than saying, here is a mess resulting from your doing X, Y, and Z, how do we tidy it up? Interesting though that question might be, the really fundamental question is, how does the way in which we resolve this mess affect the chance of that mess occurring in the future? That's the sort of the normal perspective, is a forward-looking, incentive view of the subject. All right, let me go on from that general point to discuss various bits of the law from the economic perspective. And I want to start out with property. And the first question about property is why there is such an institution. And to the non-economist, that may seem very puzzling, because it's sort of natural enough to say, look, why waste your time arguing about what's yours and what's his? Whoever needs something uses it. Right? Why? There's that car sitting unused. I need a car to get somewhere. Why don't you just forget about ignition keys? Just let me push a button to start it and I'll use the car. I'll put it back when I'm finished with it in an hour. And, you know, you can leave a note on the dashboard saying that please bring this back within an hour and a half because I'll need it then, or something like that. You can easily enough imagine institutions in which you don't have property, either private property or government property, I'm not distinguishing the two at the moment, and in which everything is a commons. People just use stuff when they want it. And the economist's response is, no, you don't understand. This is an enormously useful institution. And it's a useful institution because it solves three different problems. The first problem is getting things made. That after all, cars don't just appear out of thin air. Someone has to build them. And the private property rule says you build it, it's yours, you can use it or sell it. And that rule means that, as we discussed earlier, people have an incentive to create those things where their value, either to them or to somebody else, is at least as great as the cost of creating them. All right. So the first advantage of the institution of property, I'm now thinking specifically of private property, is it gives people an incentive, and indeed the right incentive, to make stuff. Second is it gives an incentive to take care of stuff. Because, of course, after you use my car to run your errand and then bring it back, you don't bother to refill the gas tank. You maybe don't even check that tire that's getting a little bit wobbly, and I then have problems afterwards. And more generally, the fact that I own something means that things that decrease its quality will hurt me, and things that increase its quality will benefit me, and therefore we have an incentive to take care of property. Somebody says everybody's business is nobody's business, so with private property you have an incentive to take care of possessions. And the third argument is that it allocates things to the right person. I went through that a few minutes ago. Given that there is not an unlimited supply of stuff, given that somebody is going to have to not have a car at some time when he wants it, because we're not willing to spend the resources to buy a car for everybody or to build a car for everybody. And if we built a car for everybody, we wouldn't have a house for everybody. If we had a house for everybody, we wouldn't have food for everybody, and so forth. Given a world of limited resources, we need some way of deciding who gets what. And private property plus trade gives us the result that, roughly speaking, whoever values something most ends up with it. So that sounds like a wonderful system. And then the non-economist might say, well, this is all very interesting. You've shown me that property is a wonderful rule, so why shouldn't everything be property? And at that point, the economist gets a little puzzled, because he has just shown what a wonderful thing property is, and so obviously everything should be property. So let's think about one very valuable creation of human effort, which in our institution is not property, and that's the English language. It didn't just spring out of existence. It was a result of particular people embedding words and using words and so forth. It's very, very useful. So one could imagine propertizing the English language. You could imagine a legal system in which every word belonged to somebody, the first user probably following the usual rule, and other people could only use that word if they licensed the right to use it from the first user. And there would be some advantages to that system. For example, one of the faults of the English language is that it lacks any gender indefinite pronouns. So that if you want to speak of a person without specifying male or female, which is often irrelevant to what you're saying, in English your choice is to say he or she, which is very clumsy, to say he, which is the conventional solution, but will get the feminists mad at you, and which has the real disadvantage that is ambiguous because the listener doesn't know if by he you mean specifically male or you mean anybody, or they, which will get people like me mad at you because they say, look, the English language has a logic to it. There are singular and plural, and you ought not to use they for a singular because you're then saying they is, or else you're saying they are, and thus messing things up even more. So there isn't really a good solution to how you refer to a person or to a person without specifying gender. Ah, but if only the English language were private property, some entrepreneur would say to himself, there's a big demand for such a word. A lot of people would like to license it and use it. I will think up. I will spend some real effort, not just the casual attempts people make, inventing a new pronoun, which will be a new pronoun that somehow will sound right to everybody, like just the word they were looking for meaning neither he nor she. And having invented that, I will then spend millions of dollars in a publicity campaign in order to get people to know about this new pronoun, to use it. I will maybe initially subsidize its use in some very popular novels or something. And I will then sit back and collect royalties forever after when everybody uses this. So there would be a real advantage to propertizing the English language in giving an incentive to improve that language. But there would also be a disadvantage. The disadvantage is that the transaction cost of saying anything would be very, very high, and so we never talk. All right, or right, or at least much, much less than we now do. And that, I think, suggests sort of a start to the question, why are some things not property? A different angle into that is an interesting article I read a long time ago by an economist called Martin Bailey. And the article was entitled The Approximate Optimality of Aboriginal Property Rights. And he was looking at primitive societies. And he observes that some primitive societies have private property and land and some of them don't. And it's tempting for us from our perspective to say, well, the ones that have private property and land are the advanced ones. And the ones that don't are primitive ones. They're just not right enough to have thought up such a useful idea as private property and land. They'll do it eventually. And then Bailey says there's only one problem with this explanation. And that is that there are some societies that have private property and land part of the year. So they obviously know about the idea. And yet, for some odd reason, they only sometimes use it. Why? Because, he says, private property and land is really not such a good idea. It's a good idea for certain uses of land and a bad idea for other uses. If what you're using land for is growing crops, private property is a great idea because you've got an incentive to plant the crop, to weed the crop, and so forth because you get to harvest it. But what if what you're using land for is hunting large animals across? Do you really want, having spotted the deer and chased him for the first 300 yards, to come to a boundary marker and say, oops, stay here please, deer, run off to the owner and get permission to trespass on his land, and by the time you get back, the deer is gone. So that suggests that if the main thing you're using your land for is hunting large animals across, that perhaps you don't want private property land. Maybe you want private property and animals. You want something like a hot pursuit rule, which says that if you're chasing the deer and some other member of your tribe notices you chasing the deer and says, hey, you're looking pretty tired, takes out after the deer, gets ahead of you, spears the deer, it's still your deer because you did the initial work of finding it and chasing it. Some rule like that might make sense. You can think of different possible rules. So Bailey says what's going on in these societies is that part of the year they're using the land for agriculture, part of the year they're using it for something else, and therefore they quite sensibly treat it as private property part of the year and commons part of the year. Now, that was a very good article. It's got some other things, but that's sort of was the guts of it. He argues that in fact we should expect primitive societies, if anything, to have more efficient legal rules than we do, not less, because they're sort of living on the edge. They're more likely to starve to death if they get things wrong, and therefore have a stronger incentive to get things right. So what, generalizing the point, the costs of property are you have to have some mechanism for defining who owns what. Go back to my homesteading story earlier, which is the story about the costs of defining property rights. You have costs of protecting the private property rights. You have costs of transacting. That's my licensing the English language. In circumstances where the benefits from private property are small, for example, something where you don't really need an incentive to produce it because almost all that you want is going to be produced just for the fun of it anyway, and the extra production from making a property isn't very large, something where allocation for some reason isn't a big problem, it may well be that the costs of making a private property are higher than the benefits, and therefore something like the English language should, or land you're hunting animals over should probably be a commons, whereas some other things should be private property. Let me sort of end this chunk of the discussion with my invented story of why we owe civilization to the dogs. And the story goes as follows. It's about 9,000 years ago, early in the agricultural revolution, and I am a member of a tribe, and this tribe holds this land in common. And holding land in common is a real pain, as everybody realizes, because that means that we're getting into continual arguments about whether you've done your share of the weeding today, and whether I took more of the crop when we harvested than I was entitled to, and so forth. And so I come up with this brilliant idea. And I say, I've got this great idea, I call it private property. How about we divide up the commons, each family gets a plot, they solely are responsible for planting, weeding, and harvesting, and they get all the output from that plot. And one of the old wise elders of the tribe said, yeah, kid, you're not the first one to think about that. The next tribe over the hill tried that 15 years ago, and you know what happened? What happened was the planting and the weeding went just fine, but what do you think happened when time came to harvesting? That somehow people discovered that someone else had harvested their plot. And instead of spending their time during the day arguing about who did what, they had to stay up all night guarding the crop that they had planted to make sure somebody else didn't take it. Just wasn't worth the trouble. We're better off doing it this way. You shouldn't, you know, think that just because you're young, you've got such great ideas. And so things go on that way for another 1,000 years with all of the problems of common property. And then comes the great breakthrough, the domestication of the dog. Think of it as the bionic burglar alarm. The dogs are territorial animals. You can train a dog to recognize your property as his property, at which point you can sleep comfortably during the night, and you know that if somebody comes on to harvest your crop, the dog will start barking and wake you up, and you can go beat him up with a stick or something. And from that, you get private property and land. From that, you get successful agriculture, and everything's been downhill ever since. So that's the argument for why we have civilization for the dogs. I don't know if it's true. The dates work roughly right. That is, the early agricultural revolution is close to the time of the domestication of the dog. But other than that, I just thought it was a good way of making the point that under some circumstances, private property is worth its cost. Under some circumstances, it is not. All right, let me... What I'm going to do next, but I can only just start doing it now because we're running out of time, is intellectual property. And I want to argue that intellectual property provides an application of the ideas of property versus commons I've just discussed. Because one of the striking features of intellectual property law, which people don't comment on enough, is how different patent and copyright are. That patent and copyright both come from the same sentence in the Constitution. The Constitution has no hint that they should be treated differently. And yet, we have quite different legal regimes for the two. Copyright, you get... even without asking for it. These words are already copyrighted because I'm recording them, and that means they're fixed in a tangible medium, and fixed in a tangible medium is all you need, a little bit of originality is all you need to get copyright. Furthermore, copyright lasts practically forever. And patent, on the other hand, in order to get a patent, you've got to go through an elaborate process to persuade the PTO that you've jumped through all their hoops, you've met all their criteria, and then it lasts for, 14 years or so? I don't know what maybe they changed it recently, but for a relatively short period of time. What I want to argue, and I'll let you think about it because I'll expand the argument on Wednesday, is that this fits what I've just been saying. That copyright, that the kinds of things protected by traditional copyright, I'm going to view the extension to look and feel and such as possibly a mistake, but the stuff covered by conventional copyright is stuff for which the costs of defining, recognizing, enforcing property rights are relatively low, that there's no way I'm going to accidentally write a chapter of your book, and if I do write a chapter of your book, it's easier for you to prove it's a chapter of your book, whereas patent is protecting ideas. Ideas have fuzzy boundaries. You could quite easily think up the same idea I had thought up without ever having seen my version. And we might have two ideas, which I thought yours was a version of mine and you thought it wasn't, and we were both honestly disagreeing. So therefore, I'm going to claim that patent is much less suitable for a private property regime than copyright, the subject of patent and the subject of copyright, and therefore it makes sense that we are much more willing to treat copyright as property than treat patent. So that's the argument that I'll expand on next time.